You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest this morning is Alaric Young. Alaric, did I get that first name pronounced correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay. It's good to have you here this morning, Alaric.
Well, thank you.
So the way we start the show is with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the life you aspire to live, your experience, to start the conversation about what you value and what you've learned?
Obviously a difficult question, sure. If anybody thinks about that. I guess my thoughts are you can look at a lot of different aspects of my life. For example, I'm a veteran. I serve my country, and that means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. I help run a charity. That's a big part of me. Mm-hmm. Other little things. I love books and video games and movies. Uh-huh. And I love hanging out with friends. You know, playing games with them, and you know, so I guess kind of it's a lot of little pieces about that.
Right. And it just sounds like you're really engaged with the people around you, and you've been engaged in terms of service to the country, and in terms of the of what we're going to talk about later, the Ithaca Mobile Pack, and feeding children that are starving overseas. What led you to this kind of life? What was your upbringing, or what were your personal values that have kind of, this is the way it worked out because this is what I learned?
Okay, so I'm a Mormon. I grew up Mormon. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, to me, that is a big part of kind of who I am. I believe, you know, I believe in bettering others and doing good things.
Right.
But on top of that, I you know, it's as everybody has good and bad parts to their life, I've had some disheartening times to my life, and one of the things that I focused on during those down parts of my life is if I focus on others, it you know, it helps me feel better.
Right.
That's kind of, you know, maybe those two things kind of helped me evolve into kind of who I am.
Right.
Someone who, you know, likes, you know, hanging out with people or helping people whatever it is. But as you could say, social, like being social.
Yeah. And I'm going to say this affectionately, a big kid.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Big kid.
Yeah. And because you can still engage people with that kind of freshness and optimism. I also, you know, you were talking about, you know, when you're suffering through something, serving others, we tend to see the pain that we're feeling, we tend to see it as even greater than other people's who are having maybe a similar pain. So to put it in kind of proper proportion, that serving others takes us out of ourselves and helps to kind of get a sense of the right size of things. Because when we're just by ourselves, we tend to value that even more than it may be.
It lets you see perspective from and everybody's perspective instead of just your own.
Yeah.
May not fix anything.
Part of the human condition. Yeah. To tend to go that way if we're by ourselves. Yeah. So you brought some music with you.
I did.
What should we start with?
It's a song called Have You Forgotten? Mm-hmm. I probably haven't heard it on the radio in quite some time. It was on for a while, but this song was particularly important to me. When you play the song, it'll be obvious.
Okay.
But it's you know, regarding my military service. So.
Sure.
I hear people say we don't need this war, but I say there's some things worth fighting for. What about our freedom and this piece of ground? We didn't get to keep them by backing down. They say we don't realize the mess we're getting in. Before you start your preaching, let me ask you this, my friend. Have you those towers fell, we had neighbors still inside, going through a living hell. And you say we shouldn't worry about Bin Laden. Have you forgotten? Took all the footage off my TV, said it's too disturbing for you and me. It'll just breed anger, that's what the experts say. If it was up to me, I'd show it every day. Some say this country's just out looking for a fight. After 9/11, man, I'd have to say that's right. Have you forgotten how it felt that day to see your homeland under fire and her people blown away? Have you forgotten when those towers fell, we had neighbors still inside, going through a living hell? You can bet that they remember just what they're fighting for. Have you forgotten all the people killed? Yes, some went down like heroes in that Pennsylvania field. Have you forgotten about our Pentagon? All the loved ones that we lost and those left to carry on. Have you forgotten? Have you forgotten?
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Alaric Young. So, Alaric, why that song?
The song, all right, before I joined the military, I can remember, you know, very big political situations about not wanting to, you know, not wanting to be war, join right. war and anti-war, and especially here in Ithaca.
Right.
I remember picket signs everywhere.
Right.
And
you were in. You did you grow up in Ithaca, or were you, had you moved here? You had moved here by then.
I had been here for quite some, quite a few years by that point. Yeah, but yeah. I didn't actually grow up here. But this is as home as any.
Yeah.
But you know, the song reminds me that it doesn't matter whatever the people feel. You know, this country is worth protecting, and it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily for war, but you know, we need to stand.
But you're
up
not
and
for defeat either.
No, I'm not. And so, but that's, you know, that song is, you know, brings out the patriotism that I feel. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I love that song.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel, do you feel like your values and what you honor can be honored here in Ithaca?
The one thing about America is everybody, I don't want to say entitled because it's the right word, it's the only word I can think of, but it's like we're a blend of each other.
Right.
And I think everybody's blend is important.
Right.
But, you know, this is my piece.
Right. Right.
And I think that's important.
Right. And I think, and I'm going to, everybody's specific take will be challenged by somebody else, but they have that specific take and we honor that.
Right.
without necessarily agreeing with it. You can and you can support somebody's humanity without endorsing their agenda, which I think is a position that we've kind of lost in our political life in this country. We can encourage them as human beings and not necessarily endorse what they're doing. We can even vote for them and not endorse what they're doing. And I think that's we've seen a lot of that in the past election on both sides.
Yes.
Yeah. What compelled you to join the military, and what did you learn about yourself through that experience?
Well, money, actually. Mm-hmm. I was trying to find a way to go to school.
Right.
And, you know, kind of support my life while being in school. And so I went there with an education benefit package.
Sure.
That's actually why I went into the military. Mm-hmm. Obviously, experiences, expectations and experiences are two different things
in pretty much
all cases. And so I learned a lot and come to love things part of the military and hate things as part of the military.
Right. And so what surprised you for good and what surprised you for ill the most? You did 3 tours in Afghanistan.
I did.
So,
yeah. Tours in Afghanistan, one of the things that hit me the most, which I guess we can move into later with my trip to Haiti, was, you know, the difference between America and Afghanistan. And I was also stationed in Germany.
Right.
And just the differences between the different places that I got to visit and see while I was traveling with the military. For example, Afghanistan, it wasn't uncommon to see a village made out of mud.
Right.
And, you know, mud and straw, and mm-hmm. people were living in it.
And it's dry enough that, for the most part, that works with a little patching every year or two.
And maybe sometimes somewhere you would see somebody with an access to power, and you'd see mm-hmm. a small curtain draped over a, you know, open window
right.
and out of mud, and you see light behind it.
Right.
And that was, you know, it was uncommon, but, you know, that's the kind of life. It's just nothing. Or just they just don't have the same quality of life as we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't judge them. It is their life. But
right.
it also makes you pause and think, and, you know, the differences between, you know, what we have and what they have.
Right,
fantastic.
Right. And so what did you... Okay. So you realize the abundance that we have here and the way in which they make a life in very simple ways. With what they have, but how did that? You served 3 tours. Were they all the same kinds of tours, or was it a different kind of experience each time?
I did different work each time I was there, but I worked with computers, so it was I would say easy.
Right. So you were in the background.
But
a bit.
I was in the. I was. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I was in the background, so I gotta, you know, view things from a distance. So a lot of my perspective is things from, you know, just seeing the land the way it's, you know, mm-hmm. just empty and devoid of anything but weeds and little of that, or you know, the way the land is formed and. The way I meet the people and kind of the way they interact and stuff like that. I wasn't up close to anything, but I got to see a outside perspective from that.
And you didn't end up learning the language or languages.
No.
Yeah. Cause that wasn't your role. Yeah. Yeah. So, given that you're like there, but you're not there. In terms of when you're serving, because you're doing a role that's a support role to people who are out and probably in more imminent danger than you were, but it's not necessarily safe anywhere when you're part of a force that's both welcome and unwelcome. Am I making sense? How do you navigate that internally?
Well, believe it or not, you get used to it.
Yeah.
And I'd say that regardless of what your condition is, whether you have, you know, you live in the world like we do here, you live in the world of Afghanistan, right, or you live in a world where there's constant fear of attack and danger, you get used to it.
Right.
I can remember the first time I was near an explosion, it freaked me out, and everybody else around me was like, what are you freaking out for? And then later on, fast forward a few times, there's an explosion, somebody new sitting there freaking out, and I'm going, what are you talking about?
Yeah, nothing, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's part of the environment. You get used to the environment. It's kind of, yeah, you may react. You have your automatic reactions that you're trained to accomplish.
Right, right.
But you get used to it. It's your environment. It's your world. And, you know, I think regardless of what your world is, that is your world.
Yeah. And I mean, and sometimes you don't even realize what your world is until you leave it. And I think that's part of your point when you got there. I mean, for me, when I came, when I left the Midwest to be an exchange student in Columbia, I left a place where one out of 20 of my peers wouldn't make it to the age of 20 because of violence, drugs, bad health care, picking fights with the police, all sorts. It's a rural ghetto. It was becoming a rural ghetto. And when I went to Columbia, I lived with a physician's family, a specialist family. So I was actually had more in common with their house help than I had with the family itself, because they lived at much higher standard of living. I'd only had an indoor bathroom for maybe 8 to 10 years of my life at that point. You know what I'm saying? And when I came to Cornell, there were kids coming out of inner cities who'd seen similar rates of violence, or the Adirondacks, which had similar rates of violence at the time. But most Americans don't necessarily associate that with America.
Right, right.
Yeah. So it was an internal, a major mess. And it took me probably 20 years to kind of get clear and make my peace with some of those differences. Or maybe I'm still doing it, you know, because it's a huge jump. When you came back to Ithaca, what was the return from the military like, and how many years ago was that you left service, active service?
2011 is when I came back. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of vets, it was actually very difficult transitioning back into what we call civilian life. Was exceptionally difficult for me. Count some dark times, some of the most darkest times of my life during that period.
And specifically, what for you was hard about it? What was the thing that gripped you down?
I don't know. You could say my life fell apart. I lost everything, and but a lot of it's just most of it's just a lot of it's emotions.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And inability to move on. And so I've actually, a couple of the songs that I brought today refer to that.
Sure.
Kind of, stepping back up.
Right. Let's cut to a song. What should we play next?
So this one is actually called Breakaway by Kelly Clarkson.
Okay. Here we go.
Just stare out my window, dreaming of what could
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Alaric Young. So, Alaric, after you returned from three tours and left the army and lost everything, how did you get back up? How did you find the help or the inner resources to get back up?
Well, it was day by day.
Mm-hmm.
You got up, you had to get up, you know, because what else are you going to do? And, you know, you go to work or you find work or,
right.
You know, when I...
And you're down, but you're not necessarily completely out and suicidal at that point.
No, but, yeah. You know, it's, you know, it to me, it was... No, it went, you know, at the beginning it was just, you know, it was a success if I could get up, go to right. work, and come
yep.
back.
Yep.
And, you know, that was success. And mm-hmm. then, you know, being able to get up and, you know, go shopping.
Right.
You know, those were successes. And, you know, it was literally living day to day.
Right.
The challenges of just, you know, I got to make it to work on time. Make it through the day.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can crash.
And, right.
You know.
And maybe today I have enough energy I can go out and shop for some food so that I have something to eat in the house and don't, and right. I'm not on fast food or whatever.
And, over time, things have gotten
mm-hmm.
better.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's where it started from. And you get to the point where you do further things. So, like, okay, I'm going to go, you know, someone invited me to, you know, to hang out. I'm going to go hang out. You know, that's another step of encouragement.
Right.
And, you know, I've been doing good at work. I get promotions. And all these things have built over time to kind of lift me back up.
Sure.
Out of that dark period. And, of course, one of the things that I took on towards that approach, as I alluded to earlier, was I decided to, you know, join a charity.
Right.
And Feed My Starving Children is the charity I ended up joining. It just kind of fell into my lap.
Sure.
And I've actually been working with them for like 7 years,
mm-hmm.
six or seven years.
As soon as you got back, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that has become a really big pride for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I've really appreciated the time that I've been able to help.
Right.
Help with that.
Right. So do you want to... can you describe the Feed My Starving Children and the Ithaca Mobile Pack and give people a sense of what it is that you've joined? And then we'll talk about its impact on your life as well as the impact on others.
So Feed My Starving Children, it's an organization. It's a national organization. And specifically us here, it's a small group that what we've done is we've raised money throughout the year. We've raised that money to put towards... packaging food, and this food gets shipped out to third world countries to help starving children.
Mm.
Thus the name Feed My Starving Children. You know, so, I mean, that's a really brief overview from it, but...
Right, and it goes to... the effort is to try to make it so that it can go to a place where there's been a disaster and to walk it back so that they become self-sufficient.
Right.
But that's harder in an environment where we're seeing more and more disasters more rapidly, environmentally right. and politically.
Once a year we have a pack, and we actually physically, the community gets together mm-hmm. and we package this food, you know, everybody's raised money. They've helped with this.
Right.
And we actually have this. We get to touch this, you know, have a physical experience and send the food out ourselves.
Right.
And it's amazing.
So, just to give some picture to this, you're talking about 1,300 to 1,500 people involved in packing over 4 days, and they're packing in the neighborhood of 300,000 meals.
Closer to 2,000.
Pardon?
I believe it's closer to 2,000 people for the, if you include all the volunteers
per year. Yeah.
It is a community event that's awe-inspiring. And anybody who participated knows.
Mm-hmm.
But
so how did this event connect with your life back in 2011 after you had been back for a while and you were getting involved with it?
So a member of my church was looking at he wanted to figure out how to engage the community mm-hmm. with the members of our church. You know, he felt that, you know, we were inclusive to each other and didn't have as much of a community impact as he'd like.
Right.
And he was right. like, so how do we make this happen? And so he was looking at a community, maybe not as a service, but a community event.
Right.
And a number of us had participated with the charity the year before, and mm-hmm. it was coming up again. And he's like, we should help out with this. And I'm like, he came up and he's like, you remember that event we helped out last year? And I'm like, no. And I did remember, but you know, I didn't know what he was talking about first. And
right, right.
So the two of us helped. You know, we got together and we helped the pack. We got our church congregations to help join in mm-hmm. and help to keep the pack going.
Right, and my understanding was that this is a local expression of a larger effort among the Latter-day Saints or the Mormons to become more integrated with their local communities and to be involved and to be known. And as an outsider, and part of that process was because of historical animosity between evangelical Christians and Mormons, there was some, you know, we can work together on a common good. We don't have to endorse each other. We can support each other, which is what we talked about before. And we kind of crossed that barrier with that pack. But also it brought the Mormons and the evangelicals into relationship with mainstream Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, and non-religious folks, even without having to challenge or without in any sense undermining Feed My Starving Children's devout Christian roots. Because everybody was coming to serve.
The most wonderful thing about what we have here in Ithaca with the Smallwood Pack is the fact that we are bringing everybody together, regardless of your religion or your background. Everybody who's willing to help mm-hmm. and to, you know, put forward effort is coming to make this thing happen.
So you didn't remember what your congregation member told you you'd done last year. So what was the hook that got you connected?
I'd wanted to help. I was like,
okay.
I was sitting there and I prayed to God and said, I need a service opportunity. And it was a few weeks later, he called me up and I'm like, huh, okay.
So this is the service opportunity.
And that's how Feed My Starving Children fell into my lap.
Sure.
Is I had basically been looking for something and it showed up and I was like, this is something I could support.
So what has your role been with Feed My Starving Children?
And
the Ithaca Mobile Pack, which is the way many people know it more as Ithaca Mobile Pack because it goes by both names.
So fortunately, there's a lot of us that work together and, we can all kind of help focus on some of our strengths and, asking for money is a little bit more difficult for me. Mm-hmm. What's not very difficult for me is organizing, making sure that, you know, trucks show up and, you know, we have material.
You have a lift that can move things around.
Yeah. So, yeah. Basically I helped out with logistics mm-hmm. and, you know, specifically with every year with the pack, to make sure that everything is ready to go and that, that it would happen smoothly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for me, it wasn't that difficult. It's got a lot of people to help, got a lot of people to volunteer and,
right.
Everybody got everybody to take part of their little piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And so primarily that's kind of my role is making sure that, the events themselves happen smoothly.
Right. Right. And you took that logistic role kind of, with some mentoring from First Congregational Church members mm-hmm. and then to the LDS Church. And then back to the First Congregational Church when we were back there last year, and this year it's moved to St. Catherine of Siena,
yep,
the new parish hall.
And looking forward to another year for this pack, and a lot of good fresh volunteers mm-hmm. that are stepping up to help to help run this and help put this together, and it's really refreshing.
Right. And you and a very few other people have seen this this food actually in action. One of the Sherry Johnson, one of the people who helped bring it to Ithaca in the first place with Rob Foote, had a couple of kids who had been fed by the food in Haiti years ago, and a group from Saint Catherine of Siena saw it in action in the Dominican Republic, and you actually went down to Haiti to visit. Why did you feel compelled to take that trip, and what did you see?
Well, it actually started a year before. Mm-hmm. We were having difficulty figuring out where we were going to host the next PAC. And the idea had been brought up that maybe we could figure out how to host a PAC in one of the several countries.
Right.
And the question was, is if a few of us would be willing to travel down there and help be the personal thing there. And I had thought about that for a while. You know, we ended up finding a site, and that didn't happen. But that question still stood in my mind, and I said, yeah, that would be something I'd be willing to do. And so fast forward a year later, and Feed My Starving Children sent out a notice and said, we're sending a trip down there to meet what I'll later describe as donors. We're inviting the people who helped put this together to join us. Mm-hmm. And I was like, alrighty, this sounds cool. I don't want to go by myself. So I opened it up and I was like, anybody else going to go with me? And I didn't get, I mean, a lot of people, some people were like, yeah, I'd like to, but I'm unable to.
Right.
But I didn't really get anybody. And so at first I wasn't going to go. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to an aunt of mine, and she has a son-in-law who works in Haiti. And so I'm communicating with that, you know, my anxiety and, you know, of doing a trip like this kind of evolved, and I ended up making the choice to go. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what led me up to the trip. That's what led me. Mm-hmm.
What did you find? What was the experience of the trip like for you?
I went with an open mind. I wanted to definitely keep, I'm going into third world country, but regardless of that, I was still, there was a lot of things I was surprised at, and, you know, different worlds will do that to you. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, that answer, there's so many answers that I could go over.
Sure.
I could just start with, like, the very first interaction when I got there was, if in my journal I refer to it, flying over it. I'd just flown over Florida, and I'd just seen their beaches and their all-manufactured homes and how mm-hmm. everything's been precise and clean. And then I fly over Haiti, and I see what I referred to as a shanty town. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're close enough to the ground that I can, you know, see the buildings and the few trees they had and kind of the layout things, and it looked like somebody could sneeze and everything would just fall over. And it's actually referred to as the concrete jungle. Mm-hmm. They don't have wood to make buildings with. Right. They don't have different, you know, drywall or other building materials. What they have is concrete.
Right.
Concrete and tin. And so everything is made out of concrete and tin, and thus the term concrete jungle. Everything you're looking at, that's what they build with. Mm-hmm. That's primary. And to me, that was such a shock, coming from, you know, what I would consider, you know, a beautiful house is, you know, made with, you know, look down the street. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, that was one of the very first things that right. I saw.
And in the tropics, most stuff is, regardless of their access to wood, most stuff is concrete because it's the only thing that lasts, or cinder block. Yeah.
And so the next thing that really got me was, let me preface this, I did not see any violence there. Mm-hmm. But what I did see was the effect of it. When you go down the road the typical, what the typical site is on the side of the road are these concrete walls,
right?
With Constantine wire on top of it, and in some cases, broken bottles cemented into the top of the wall.
Right.
The doors would be these gigantic big tin doors with, more often than not, a guard with a shotgun posted.
And these were the more affluent buildings or spaces.
That was not uncommon. Down, you know, some of the denser parts, and you can see, you know, where someone didn't have the ability to put up a wall, and you can kind of see their thing. But in more of the places downtown in Port-au-Prince, it was, or really in the entire country, mm-hmm. The general concept is you put your wall up first before you build your house,
right.
type feeling.
Right.
And, you know, that just, you know, like I said, I didn't see the violence, but you could feel it.
Right, right.
And you know, so.
So where did you go from there? Where did you, what did you become aware of next? You're living in a place where there's a lot of controlled violence and in places you're not seeing, it's happening. But it's yeah.
So I stayed in a hotel. It was actually right across the street from the airport. It, you know, they had their own guards. It was pretty mm-hmm. safe as far as anything can be. So that wasn't really a concern. But you know, the point of going down there was to meet our partners.
Right.
The partners down there, what they are is they're basically a group down there who is managing whatever their point is.
So the Feed My Starving Children doesn't actually deliver the food to people who receive it. They work with non-governmental organizations in those places, and they deliver it to them, and those people distribute it.
Correct. For example...
And they decide how it gets and where it gets distributed right. to themselves. Mm-hmm. And just as it has a very high success rate of getting food to people in need, but it doesn't control the selection of those people.
Right. So, for example, the first place I met was is a place called Love a Child. Mm-hmm. You can call it a distribution center. You could call it orphanage. You could call it a school.
Right.
It's all of those things. It's all of these things yeah. in once. And when we arrived, they were actually unloading a truck of Feed My Starving Children food. So that was really cool. But you know, the couple who's been there for years, when showed us their warehouse, was one of the first things we got to see. And in their warehouse, you see racks upon food, clothes. There was even food from other organizations other than Feed mm-hmm. My Starving Children.
Right.
And he told us stories about, you know, where he takes the food. Stories that, you know, still make me cry to this day.
Right.
He showed me a side of the building where, depending on where the food go, they would have to repackage it so that the locals didn't know what was in it. Right. Otherwise, they would attack the truck.
Right. And that's how... Yeah.
Now also on the same time, on the same place, this was also an orphanage in a school. He had 600 students. These are all children, elementary school and a little bit older. But 450 of them were actually orphans.
Right.
And so he housed and fed and took care of these 450 children, you know, on the site. And that, and a lot of the partners that I met over there were a haven, you could say, for mm-hmm. many reasons. A distributor of food, a school, and, you know, an orphanage and that sort of thing. And then brings up a point about Feed My Starving Children is the fact that they care about rebuilding. It's not mm-hmm. just about feeding. And so this concept... you know, is seen mm-hmm. a lot with also the partners and the right. fact that, you know, I'm not just going to feed the kids. I'm going to teach them.
Right.
You know.
And they're also going to feed parents in a time, for example, when they need to build up their business. If they have another venture that they're trying to do, the food not only goes to the children, but it goes to the parents for a period of time so that they can establish whatever business or piece that's going. just let me step in. There is also an element. One of the reasons why the local Ithaca Mobile Pack group was not able to sponsor a packing event overseas, particularly in Nicaragua, where they've done it before, or perhaps Honduras, was because the local food production systems are not producing up to that scale that they can generate the surplus locally. And when you carry in food from the West to pack it, from basically the United States to pack it, it becomes infinitely more expensive to pack it and to deliver it around the country, which is why we didn't do it. But there's this disconnect that Feed My Starving Children is aware of. They need to support the food infrastructure of these countries so that they don't need to be reliant on outside food, but they haven't figured out how to deal with the cost differential.
There are some. They do have projects in place where they have managed to do it. It's still on small scales.
And I think in Turkey they've said, or in, but not in Central America or the Caribbean yet.
It's still difficult.
Yeah. So what else did you see there in your travel?
The my most favorite place I went to, a series of schools,
mm-hmm.
and these schools were also orphanages. It's like a network of schools in the area, and some of these schools in this network of schools housed the disabled or the deaf.
Mm-hmm.
There was at least one school for the disabled. There were three schools for the deaf, and I got to go visit one of the deaf schools.
Mm-hmm.
And of someone who just had a love of sign language.
So you sign?
Yes, a little bit. But more importantly, I understand that the roots, because sign language is different from country to country.
Sure, sure.
The roots come from the same place. And so kind of my hope was I could go down there and actually maybe talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and visited one of these schools, orphanages, and I got to sit down and talk with one of the teachers as the school was letting out. Her name was Mimosa. And it was a difficult conversation, as there was a lot of barriers. But that was just amazing. And, getting to actually get in touch and talk with somebody who's doing their best effort, for their own home,
right,
to help raise and to improve kids.
Right. And to do it with sign language and with gesture and all the other things that you do to try to communicate.
She actually had to interpret for me for the kids, because the kids talked too fast and I didn't understand enough.
Oh, yeah.
And so some of the kids would come up and they wanted to talk to me, and I would transfer the questions back so that we could understand.
Wow.
And the one question I can recall is like, where was I from type of question.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And it was, he's 3 hours away on an airplane. And I'm like, no, I'm not 3 hours away. I'm like 10 hours away. I took three or four planes to get here.
Right.
And, it's not just that simple to get here. Just,
mm-hmm.
That would have been awesome if that was.
Right.
See the look on their face.
Sure.
So that school was an amazing thing for me, because mm-hmm. A little bit easier for me to, because I could actually communicate and talk with them and, feel it a little bit better.
Right.
But like, just the people in general down there that are putting their effort into making their country better, is just something that I think amazed me a lot.
Right. So let me shift the focus just a little bit. And this is about you as a volunteer. From what I've read or seen, volunteers are good. You have about half of the people after 5 years for something that they're deeply committed to. But after about 10 years, there's been almost a complete turnover. Do you feel yourself continuing with this, or if you were to move to something else, what would you see? You know, how you seem very connected to this now, and that trip to Haiti seemed to re-cement that tie. How do you see your role in the future?
I don't know. Yeah.
You're responding.
Okay,
so opportunity. Yeah.
I'm gonna back up a little bit. One of the questions that I went down there with was, I'm the eyes and ears for Ithaca.
Sure.
A lot of people are putting a lot of effort and time into supporting this organization. Is it worth it?
Yeah.
And I went down there, and I wasn't just looking for the food, which, you know, specifically why.
And we've sent food to Haiti at least three out of the 7 years, if not more, that we've sent food.
Yeah. I was looking at, you know, do they really need help?
Yeah.
You know, are they really that destitute?
Yeah.
They are.
Well, yeah.
But what I got to see, though, was how not just Feed My Starving Children, but all the other charities, all the other, you know, commercials that you ignore on the TV because you don't want to, they're disturbing, you kind of just either change
channel. Or there's too much for you to respond to.
Or you can't, but, you know, all these charities, they are down there.
Right.
And I got to see the effects of them. And I could see that they actually made a difference. And so, you know, yes, I'm invigorated by my trip to Haiti. Right. And, you know, I don't believe Feed My Starving Children is the only answer.
Right.
I think it is a major, big part of the answer. But I think, you know, keeping, you know, we as, especially in America, have a lot of people have put together efforts to help, you know, in Haiti and other places, and it is making a difference.
Right. And food aid is a little bit like raising children. You need to take them from dependence to independence, and we don't know what that looks like oftentimes when we're parents raising children, and we often don't know what that looks like when we're providing aid to places that need it. How do we make this so that we can deal with the crises as they arise, but the longer term is a sense of independence and autonomy that people can have. But Haiti has suffered for centuries, you know, around these sorts of issues of poverty and need.
So, I'd like to share a story.
Sure.
And I sat down and spoke with an individual. Me being very judgmental at times, my first thought was, it's a crazy local environmentalist type thing. You know, he's weirdo. That was my first impression of him for most of the thing. You know, he'd lived in a, you know, repurposed mud hut, and he went and he talks about how to save the environment and stuff like that, right? And, you know, that was my in first Haiti. Impression. In Haiti, yeah. He goes around the schools. And
he's Haitian.
He's Haitian, yes. And I listened to him. My viewpoint of him drastically changed by the end. And he showed us this quilt, made a sequence that he had someone build. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could show everybody the picture of it.
Sure.
But it is it's a picture of a forest fire, and the animals are running from the forest fire. And all except for a hummingbird. And a hummingbird is taking water from a leak and dropping it on the fire. And as you can imagine, it doesn't make much impact. Right. So the animals are saying, what are you doing? You can't possibly make a difference and put out this fire. And the hummingbird responds, I'm doing my part.
Yeah. Yep. That's right.
And so he had made this beautiful quilt of us, and he brings it to the schools, and he's like, look. And he's talking about health. He's talking about, in this specific case, it was trash cleanup.
Right.
You know, from the storm.
Keep it a cleaner neighborhood and a cleaner environment.
You know, from the storms, you know, the devastation, one of the side effects is that there's literally garbage everywhere.
Right.
And one person cannot physically clean it up. The government can't figure it. It's too big of a process. Right. And so his thing is, look, if we all do our part, we make a difference.
Right.
And I pick up the trash specific because I actually got to see that. I got to see it from, you know, the dirty parts to the parts that have been cleaned up to the cities where everybody's outside their own home digging out the ditches and putting, you know, trash in a pile for somebody to come to get. And right. it was an enormous, huge effort that I actually physically had to see the process taking slow, but yes, they're right. working on it.
And a volunteer effort, which would largely be unpaid.
Yes.
And that's the other piece of it. Let's shift gears here. You've been through a lot between your time in Afghanistan, coming back, trying to rebuild your life. What have you learned works to take care of yourself, physically, emotionally, and intellectually? And how do you know you need to? Part of this is serving others, which gets you out of your own space. But what do you learn? What have you learned that on a daily basis helps you to maintain or to find a balance when you feel it coming off?
People.
Oh, really?
I often joke. Yeah. I like to joke, but I call people my drug.
Yeah,
it's my feel good drug. It's when I'm not around people that mm-hmm. it's really true the hardest.
Right.
But whether it's at work, whether I'm hanging out with friends or whoever it might be, it's the people that really have given me the energy to live day to day and to really become more of me again. And it's the communications, the connections that I have with people.
Mm-hmm. And when do you sense that your people time is not enough? When what happens to you internally? How do you know that I need to engage? How do you know that you need to engage others?
Mostly when I'm not around somebody.
Uh-huh. But
when I'm by myself.
What do you notice? What do you notice internally that I need to fix this? What goes wrong is what I'm trying to say. That you realize, oh, I've been isolated. I need to get out of this. How do you realize that?
The way I look at the world becomes darker. My attitude's darker, more pessimistic. Uh-huh. It's emotions.
Right.
It's this is one of the things I've had to learn is how do I change my perspective of the world? You know, it's like if you smile long enough, you'll eventually be happy. You know, if you, when you're first starting smile, you're probably not really happy. You're just faking it.
Right. Or you're wanting to be happy and the desire sometimes is fulfilled.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've had my own journey with my emotions in my life. Mm-hmm. And, so I've learned that, you know, I can joke and be happy. I can have a much more positive me.
Right.
When I'm around people.
Right. And did you grow up to be kind of emotionally aware, or was that something you've had to learn because of how you got knocked down?
No, that I've had to learn.
Right.
But I'm a different person because of it.
Yeah.
You know, as we all evolved, but yeah.
Yep. Alaric, it has been wonderful to get to know you. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
You wanted to close with The Gospel by Ryan Stevens. And do you want to say anything about that before we play it?
I am deeply religious, and I believe that God is my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And this song has a particular interesting touch to the view of religion in someone's life.
Right. And the God is your friend is also when you befriend people and people befriend you, you become as God to each other, which is very powerful. Here we go.
This generation, we're turning over every stone, hoping to find salvation in a world that's left us cold. Can we get back to the altar, back to the arms of our first love? There's only one way to the Father, and He's calling out to us. To the captive, it looks like freedom. To the orphan, it feels like home. To the skeptic, it might sound crazy to believe in a God who loves. In a world where our hearts are breaking and we're lost in the mess we've made, like a blinding light in the dead of night, it's our condition. It's the good news for us all. It's greater than religion. It's the power of the cross. So can we get back to the altar? Back to the arms of our first love. There's only one way to the Father, and he's calling out to us. To the captive, it looks like freedom. To the orphan, it feels like home. To the skeptic, it might sound crazy to believe in a God who loves. In a world where our hearts are breaking, and we're lost in the mess we've made, like a blinding light in the dead of night, it's the gospel that makes a way. It's the gospel that makes a way. It's the gospel that makes a way.
Amazing news of the gospel is not that we can receive Jesus into our lives, but that he's already received us into his.
In my own life, it means forgiveness. When I know I deserve the fall, it called me out of my darkness and carried me to the cross. In a moment.